W-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
It's a special kind of person that has the ability to walk in and see the burns and see the emaciation and not do anything about it.
They sort of start sinking down a hole together. It's religion, but then it's also this really odd community-based, partner-based sort of shared extremism. The partnership allows Jody to become more and more and more extreme.
They're just upset they got caught. True crime enthusiasts, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host, I'm Jen Coffendaffer, and today we have such a great episode lined up. We're going to be talking about Ruby Frankie, specifically after some of the new revelations regarding her treatment of her children have been released. We are joined today by Dr. Eppright. She is amazing, a doctor of behavioral science and currently a professor at Furman University. Her accolades and her accomplishments academically in terms of studying the behavioral psychiatry of individuals goes on and on. We're thrilled to have Dr. Eppright. Remember, we're going to cuss and discuss crime, and I really care about what you think. Please put your comments below, and also you can find me at Coffendaffer FBI on Twitter X. Also pay close attention to those comments. So without further ado, Dr. Camilla Eppright. Dr. Eppright, we are so glad to have you join us regarding some very interesting information that has recently come into the news. First of all, what we have, of course, is new information regarding Ruby Frankie and how she treated and abused her children. So it's obviously very disturbing, the pictures that have come to light, the duct tape, the wounds on them, the skeletal figures that we're really looking at. I know when I first saw the picture of her son and the scapula bones pointing out his back, it really reminded me of pictures from Auschwitz in terms of the children when you saw them from behind. But my question for you, doctor, what makes a mother torture, deny food, deny drink, do this, and supposedly in the name of religion, if you will, that this was proper? Please enlighten us.
I mean, I wish I knew. I wish all of us knew. I think we would be really good for all of us to know. I don't know if I think it's only religion. I mean, when she started out the channel, it's very interesting to go back to the beginning and watch this sort of gradual. She's a really pretty warm mother at first, and then it gets, you know, sort of more and more and more punitive, and then certainly with the older son, and the older son goes away to a wilderness camp. I just can't help feeling that it's not just as much about religion as it is about this very disturbed relationship. Right, and I know that we're going to talk today both about Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrand, and then also about the other couple. Boy, the LDS religion is not doing well right now, and I feel kind of bad for, you know, Latter-day Saints right now, except that it's not them. It's their followers who then become fringe. And so I think with Ruby, it starts as a Mormon. Clearly, they have, you know, multiple children. They end up having six children, and they've got the vlog, the eight passengers, right? And she's, you know, and at first it's her and her husband, and then they end up meeting Jody Hildebrand, and they, you know, they send their kid away to a, you know, a sort of discipline camp, which we know have been very controversial, and kids come back abused depending on what you're sending them there for. And it's sort of after that that it becomes open season. So I want to say it's not just the religious aspect. It's religion, but then it's also this really odd community-based, partner-based sort of shared extremism. They sort of start sinking down a hole together. And I think Jodi Hildebrand clearly, you know, she had problems before. She had lost her license, or she had her license suspended. So she ends up becoming this very suspect thing of a life coach, right? The life coach. But it doesn't have a meaning, and it doesn't have a legal meaning, and it doesn't, you know, you're not bound by any sort of professional obligations. And the partnership allows, I think, Jodi to become more and more and more extreme. It almost feels to me, I'd love to hear what you had to say about it, it almost feels to me like, well, like, I think Ruby almost becomes a passenger herself.
Yes, she kind of does. But for me, and even though Jodi Hildebrand obviously was the one that I think, was it a catalyst, maybe? I think she was already always, Ruby was already down that road. But certainly when you have a partner in crime, the crime is so much easier to commit because you can go back and forth with one another and sort of inspire, if you will, the other that what they're doing is correct. But I'm very interested in what you mentioned about this gradual display of disciplinary action. Can you bring us back to that and walk us through what you saw?
So at first, you know, if you listen early on, and people start to become really suspicious as it goes on. I mean, she did this for years. She starts when she's pregnant with Eve, which is the youngest child. And, you know, at first there are moments where she seems like a warm mother, right? That she's disciplining the kids, and she very specifically says at certain points, all the discipline happens off screen. And that could be scary, but it's also in some ways a good thing, because I think it becomes even more delusional. Delusional is not the perfect word. It becomes more extreme when she no longer feels like she has to do it off screen, right? Mm-hmm. When a lot of people target the one, there's a car accident, right? She's bringing all the kids to school on the first day of class, and there's a car accident, and she's filming it. And all of the kids are just freaking out, obviously. It's very scary, you know, that one of the people had a car that the airbags went off in. Everybody's okay. But she's got all six of the kids in the van, and one of them's sobbing. And she's got the camera on them. And it becomes this, you know, my entire life is part of this world that I'm building. And I'm perfectly happy to sort of bring my children into that. My children don't have privacy. My children don't have intimacy in some ways. We don't have discussions that aren't filmed. And mom's kind of always got the video camera on. And so she starts to build kind of a following, this, you know. It's interesting in her case, too, because it becomes the family business. I think her sisters had actually started being vloggers before she did. And then she sort of gets into the kind of family business. I know her parents also do some vlogging. And it sort of becomes this very natural thing to live your life on camera. It's actually sort of the new reality shows, right? We're really used to at this point, Kim Kardashian and the Kardashian family. But somebody else is filming that. Right. Their life is being filmed, but it's being filmed by somebody else. This is mom constantly having a camera in their face, right? Which means that mom becomes this sort of, it's a very weird figure to be your mother, but then also be sort of the portal to the public in some ways. And so your life kind of gets chipped away. You don't really have a family life in quite the same way. So she ends up sending her oldest son, Chad, to Jodi Hildebrand, and they do some counseling. She ends up sending him to this wilderness camp, and there becomes a movement among her listeners of the Free Chad, the hashtag Free Chad movement, because they can see it. She is so down the rabbit hole of having her world be through the lens of her own camera that she doesn't even seem to really realize the impact it's having on her children. And then she hires Jody Hildebrand to be her life coach. And that separates her from her husband, right? Her husband is, you know, he needs to leave because he's a bad force on the family. And you're not even allowed to see your children. It creates this world where they're allowed to do anything they want. Jody and Ruby together do whatever they want because the husband's not even overseeing it. He is trying, or at least according to him, he's trying to get back. I want to be accepted back. And what she's telling me I need to do is get away from them. I need to get away from them. And then if I do that, I'll eventually get back. And meanwhile, her children are over at Jody Hildebrand's house being chained to beds. And so they created a world that, you know, first of all, it's a world that she kind of is watching her own children through the lens of a camera. At least I think she is. And then, you know, she sort of expands her world to let in Jody Hildebrand. And the two of them together start becoming more and more and more extreme with the children. And the kind of discipline that Jody is doing, she's making her children exercise out in the hot sun. They have to earn being able to drink. They have to earn being able to eat. And they really start to think of themselves as evil, right? And I think that, for me, is when it all went off the cliff, right? It's sort of one thing to just be an abuser. Being an abuser is bad enough. But when you actually convince your children, no, I deserve this. This is actually the way I deserve to be treated. This is me. I am the bad one. And it is particularly strong in the little girl. The little boy, when he finally escapes and he goes to the neighbors and says, I'm thirsty. And he looks like a concentration camp victim. I think it's very interesting that you use that analogy. It is the analogy that the judge used when he was hearing Jody Hildebrand's plea, where he said, you treated these kids like they were in a concentration camp. So I think you're right about that. I'm personally very interested in kind of the partnership, right? That when we get these two people together, we bring out the absolute worst in both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, remember, a lot of people, Dr. Eppright, want to say that the father should also be punished. But I'm hearing you make an argument that indeed he was on the outside. But Dr. Eppright, don't you believe a lot of these punishments started before Jody Hildebrand? Oh.
I don't think chained to the bed is, but no, you're right. She makes them earn eating. You know, you have to do your chores. I know that this makes me sound like a monster, she says into the camera, right? Sounding very much like a monster, she says into the camera, but I'm not even letting them eat breakfast before they do their chores, right? Her little girl is 6 years old and she's supposed to pack her own lunch to go to school and she forgets and the teacher calls and she says, nope, she's six. She should have packed her own lunch. And if she didn't, the consequence for that is being hungry. And I hope to God that you don't feed her because then she won't learn. And then Chad, the older boy, loses the right to have a bed. He loses the right to have any privacy at all. And all of them sort of do, right? They're always constantly on camera. They are part of her content, right? They become objects in many ways. And I do wonder if that's part of it, right? Her children become objects for her business, right? And then it sort of feels okay to have your child sleeping, your 15-year-old sleeping on a dog bed for 9 months.
Basically dehumanize them, and that is what kind of allowed her, perhaps, to be able to be so ruthless in her treatment of them?
I think I would say that. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it, but I think you're right, and I'm the one that said objective, that they become objects. But that does seem to start it, right? Like, I am going to put the camera on you, even though you are terrified by this car accident. I'm going to have the camera on you. She says at one point, you know, I never forget to vlog. I never forget it. It's like, I don't forget to eat. I wake up in the morning and I get the camera out. And so my entire life is open to everyone else. And these are my children. And what I'm known for is being the great mother. I'm the perfect mother. And that's what I'm doing here is I'm giving mothering advice. And these are sort of my objects, right? And they are feeding into my world. world and they're feeding into by business. And she makes them have these weird things where they're supposed to pay her for things. They're earning money. They are objects. And I do think that starts it down the road. I don't know that I think she would have chained them to beds, though, if it hadn't been for her relationship with Jody Hildebrand. I don't know.
When I look at that relationship and just the whole vlogging and the 8 passengers, for me, from a law enforcement standpoint, I just see this as 2+ million followers, millions of dollars she is making at this, and really a ruthless businesswoman that the more egregious, really, that she treated her children, it would seem, at least when they were on camera, the more heartless she got, it didn't affect her following and, in fact, possibly increased her following. To me, that's disturbing.
Except that towards the end, the more she sort of sinks into this relationship, she stops kind of working on the vlog, right? She moves away at the very end from doing the vlog. I think it's sort of something did tip her over the edge, right? At first, they are part of her business. I am completely with you. You know, the followers, the money. It's really weird that she's doing this money exchange with them because this is a very wealthy woman at this point. But by the time it starts sliding down the road of this kind of abuse that we go on to see, like these children who have rope burns that are like torn into their muscles and their legs. I mean, it is so vile to look at this. But by the time we're there, she's no longer doing the vlog anymore.
Right.
Or she's doing it very rarely. Right. She moved away from doing that to sort of being sucked into this relationship. I don't know. I think that's a really interesting moment in all of this. Right. They were pieces on a chessboard. But then the chessboard became less important than the relationship.
That is true. And I wanted to ask you about that. Do you feel like these women had more than just a business relationship?
You know, I did think about that, and I don't have any evidence of that. I mean, I do. Ruby clearly kind of worships Jody, I think. I'm not sure that that's reciprocal. I think Jody is really used to being in power over people, right? I think she's really used to being a therapist, and she's really used to being this, you know, she is used to having a lot of power over family. She's a counselor, and then she goes on to become a life coach. I think Ruby was certainly obsessed with her. Do I think it's sexual? I don't know if that's what you were asking. I don't know. It's possible. But I do think that there was sort of a... It was an unequal relationship. I think Ruby really, really admired Jody, and Jody sort of drove the bus, or the van, as it may be.
Right. Ruby became a passenger in the bus.
I think so. I mean, that's what it seems like to me. And then in her apology where she, you know, she's pleading guilty, and I don't know what to think about that. People have been very critical of it. There's a part of me that's critical of it. I think it's absolutely possible that she's being manipulative, right? I am going to apologize to literally everyone. I'm going to apologize to the police that arrested me. I'm going to apologize to the prosecutors who are prosecuting me. You saved the life of my children. And she does say, you know, I was taken down a dark hole by another person. But I don't think that needs to be mitigating for my sentence here. I am not claiming any mitigation. I will tell you that I was enveloped in darkness. People see that as really inauthentic. I'm not going to say that it was authentic. But we do ask criminal defendants to do that, right? And you almost never get anything that explicit. Right? We will often say, well, they didn't show any remorse at all. Right. We want them to show remorse. We want them to acknowledge that they've done something wrong. And so Ruby Frankie really, really goes out of her way to acknowledge that she did something wrong and really to kind of look at every single person that was involved in saving her children's life. And she is thanking all of them. I don't know. You know, I think at that point, criminal defendants, there's nothing they can do right. But I definitely think that's better than a lot of the alternatives I've seen. What did you think of it?
It's so interesting. I think because you come from a place of maybe I don't know, looking at everything in full circle and more deeply maybe than me, because
I don't know.
I was repulsed. I'm so sorry to say it.
No, tons of people were repulsed.
I felt it was an absolute abomination. I thought that it was contrived. Especially when you hear the tapes that were recorded of them from prison, what they have to say, and the way that they, you know, shirk responsibility and say actually things didn't happen that way. So for me, I saw it as how no remorse about what she did. I mean, I know the words were there. They're just upset they got caught.
No, I think you're right. Do you actually think towards the end that she really was just upset that she got caught? You don't think there's any insight there at all?
Okay, no.
This is why we're talking to each other.
And I think it's fine for both of us to have a different opinion on that.
No, I don't know that it's really my opinion. I am not going to say that it was totally authentic. Here's what I will say. What is it that we want criminal defendants to say? Honestly. I think at some point they really, maybe they should just shut up and not say anything at all. But we would also be critical if she wasn't remorseful.
No, you bring up a good point. And I guarantee her counsel told her, listen, I need you to put on your best acting job right here, because you need the judge to hear out of your mouth everything you're sorry about, because this is going to affect your sentencing and the rest of your life and whether you're ever going to get out. So truly, I think it was a good acting job. But for me, this is why I think this, I'll put it in a nutshell. The chances of you or me or hopefully anyone in our audience doing this to a child or one of your children, so let's take it a step further, not somebody you don't know, a child, but one of your own children that you've had, that you've reared, that you've taken care of, that is a special kind of person. It's a special kind of person that has the ability to walk in and see the burns and see the emaciation day after day and not have any ability to either recognize it or just not care about it and not do anything about it. And I don't think that a few days in jail ever changes the heart of a child abuser and the heart of a parental abuser. So for me, she could have gotten up there and wings could have grown on her back, showing that she had become an angel.
Well, I certainly don't think that's going to happen.
I wouldn't have bought it.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I do, that speech to me seemed a little bit like, I would like someday to have a relationship with my children again, right? I actually thought maybe the best audience for that was her children. Right. That at some point, I would really hope that in the future, when this is all over, that at some point I'm going to have a relationship with you. The one that was really authentic, I mean, inauthentic, right? The one that was incredibly inauthentic was the Jody Hildebrand. Oh, I love these children as though they're mine. She speaks for, what, 30 seconds, a minute and a half, you know, like barely any. Oh, no, really, I absolutely love them. They're, you know, they're like my children, you know, and then she was so inauthentic. She was just completely inauthentic. I don't know. I kind of thought maybe Ruby was a little more complicated. I am not saying that it wasn't bullshit, right? We can swear on this,
yeah,
right?
We
said we're cussing and discussing. I mean, it was complete bullshit. But it's also, I don't know, it's the first step down a road that if we're ever going to have her take responsibility, it's got to start somewhere. But Jody Hildebrand had no interest in taking any responsibility at all.
So I want to get back to your question, because you said, you know, where does a defendant go? Do they not say anything? Do they prepare these speeches like we heard from Ruby? What's the right answer? I think as a judge, if I would have been a judge, I would have wanted to hear this. I am reprehensible. What I did was sickening. I can't wrap my mind about how little emotion and little humanness I had to have to treat a child like this. And you know what, Judge? When I'm behind bars, I need therapy. I need help. I'm a sick individual. And all I can do is ask you for mercy and for proper programs. That's what I want to hear.
Yeah, I don't know. You don't think that was what she said? No, well, I mean, to say, I'm not asking for your mercy. I'm not. I don't think anything I say here, I am not defending her. I know that I'm going to get all kinds of mail on this, and people are going to say, how dare you defend her? Because I'm not actually defending her. I'm really trying to get at this question of, what do you do? How do you begin to start taking responsibility? You know, she does say, I don't know, maybe she didn't say she was monstrous. She says, you know, I am not asking for less time. I'm not doing that. I wanted my children to be alive. I am grateful that my children are alive. I need to thank all of you because my children would not be alive if it wasn't for you. She never really does say, I'm sick, you need to put me in therapy, and maybe actually you should pretty much lock me up forever because if anyone was willing to do this, they're just incredibly monsters and maybe they're just never going to, you know, what I've heard is that she may end up spending as little as 40 months in prison.
That's true.
And that's disturbing. I guess if I had to guess, I would say Jodi Hildebrand's going to get more time than she is. But I don't think either one of them are going to get enough.
No, they're not going to get enough. It's on the table. But as soon as I saw that the judge said, or part of the plea agreement was whatever is recommended in terms of their early release would not be contested by the prosecution, I said, okay, it's going to be very light, even though they're consecutive sentences.
Right.
That was good to hear, you know, one after another. But I agree with you. It's going to be a low overall sentence and nothing can be enough.
What did you think of the prosecutor coming out and saying, you know, this woman really worked with us? I mean, the prosecutor had good things to say about Ruby Frankie and said that she was pretty authentic. Which I thought was really weird. I don't think I've ever heard a prosecutor say anything like that before. So I don't know, what did you make of that?
You bring up a good point. And that, just that the prosecution side, with the overwhelming evidence that they had, would even do a deal. There was nothing, in my opinion, as a prosecutor, I'm not doing a deal. I have a rock solid case. I have these victims that were tortured and tormented. They were in their care. You have them able to testify. The only thing that would have bothered me was putting them on the stand. And, you know, I would have tried to make that in a very special situation where it was videotaped outside the courtroom. I would have tried to do everything I could to make that as, you know, little of, you know, traumatizing as possible. But having said that, I definitely saw that this prosecutor seemed under the spell, a little bit in the bus, and it bothered me. You know, he was there. He is more privy than any of us, right? All we get to see is what window is opened. But Dr. Eppright, I was bothered by that. And I just feel like a lot of these women and men, but in this case, these women, particularly Ruby, was she able to get him a little bit under her spell?
I don't know. And I do worry about that, right? Because I think the next case we're going to talk about is Lori Vallow Daybell and Chad Daybell. And it is really interesting that they're women, right? In all of these cases, it's women, that there might be more of a sense of, well, she's a woman, right? Like, she's going to come around. She's a mother. I mean, look at what she did as a mother, though. I mean, let's be clear about what happened with her as a mother. But I do wonder, it's going to be very interesting to see the trial of Chad Daybell. I do wonder how that is going to be treated and if it is going to be different than Lori Vallow. Because I think we are more likely to hold him Well, I mean, first of all, death penalty's on the table for him. Now, that does come from an error on the part of the prosecution. So the prosecution in Lori's case did not actually file something on time, which is why death penalty was taken off the table. It wasn't because they weren't going to pursue it. I don't actually know what they were going to do, but they didn't do it. And so it's not exactly equivalent. You can't really just say, well, why is he on trial for a death penalty case and she's not. I think there was an error at stake there, and hopefully they're not going to make the same error for Chad Daybell. But I wonder what the perception is going to be of him. Is he going to be held more responsible than her? And then the Ruby Frankie, and going back to Jody Hildebrand, Ruby Frankie, I wonder if being women had something to do with this. Right? Because if a man got up there, no one would believe it. Nobody would. I mean, I'm not going to believe it, but at least I was going to listen to it. But I think if a man got up there, nobody would listen at all. Don't you think?
I think that it is viewed differently. And I think the sadness of all of that is I think Ruby Frankie realizes that. You know, she's a fairly attractive woman. Yep. I noticed that she looked almost better.
She did look, didn't she? Oh my God.
How she did her hair, and then just the subtle, I think she had on makeup. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she just looks better with no makeup. But her whole presentation was soft and was, I think, she looked better.
This reminded me, I'm going to use, this is way callback. This is way callback. She reminded me of Mary Kay Letourneau.
Yes.
Do you know who that is? Isn't that bizarre? It's the first thing that went through my head of Mary Kay Letourneau in her first, when she's being sentenced for the first time. She's got that very soft, I mean, she was a very beautiful woman, but she has this very soft look, and she's doing this, and she's kind of using her hands, and it just reminded me of her. It's like the script and the body language, all of it, and it makes you look vulnerable and sad and regretful all at once, while at the same time you're beautiful and it's really working for you. Isn't that true? Is that a strange thing to have thought about? I don't know.
No, I agree with you. And look at what happened with Letourneau, as we all talked about at that time. If she would have been a man raping, you know, a young girl, everybody would have been up in arms, slammed the prison cell. And
a 12-year-old. So Mary Kay Letourneau. 12. So we haven't told everyone what Mary Kay Letourneau, of course, is.
Yeah, go ahead, set it up.
Right, Seattle woman who falls in love. I mean, boy, this woman is really sick too. Boy, all of these women we're going to talk about today really need to call their therapist, right? Like, there's the thing, they need to be calling their therapist. Yeah. But Mary Kay Letourneau falls in love with a 12-year-old, he's a sixth grader, and then later we'll come back and go, well, you know, and everybody does, it's not just her. I mean, well, he was a really mature kid, which male predators do all the time. Oh, well, you know, she was really mature, and she was, you know, kind of coming on to me. But she really says this, and so she has sex with him. She ends up pregnant, even in her first trial, I think she is pregnant, with this 12-year-old's baby. And then, it's not her first trial. She is pleading guilty to a special, some kind of special defendant. They're going to give her therapy and they're going to give her some time. And if she just completed it and then did parole afterwards and didn't get in any more trouble, she was going to be okay. She was going to walk away from this. I don't think she would have time. But she couldn't. The first night she gets out, they find her parking with this now 14-year-old. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And you're right. If it had been a man, I don't know. I think we would have executed him. There is no way anyone would have been sympathetic to her. But I just remembered her when I looked at Ruby Frankie when she was speaking to the judge. Just the whole demeanor reminded me of Mary Kay Letourneau, who really in that when she's pleading guilty and she wants to be part of this, you know, she's going to go ahead and do the therapy. She's really apologizing. She's talking about having done harm. And she has this saint-like Madonna quality to her. Is that kind of what you saw?
I agree, but you just totally made my point.
I know, and I've gone back on my own point, so you know.
Yeah, because Letourneau, just like Ruby Frankie, with the Madonna look, we don't mean, by the way, the singer. We're talking about Mother Mary.
We're talking about Via.
Because
both of us grew up Catholic. We're talking about...
Really? Madonna? Like a virgin? Not that one. But anyway, yeah, she certainly had that. They do that on purpose, and they're very well coached. I mean, these attorneys aren't dumb. This isn't their first rodeo, and they want to get their client off, and they coach them. I guarantee wrote the script, or at least edited the script that was going to be read or memorized and what it needed to have in it. And to my point, she wasn't any more sorry about having sex with a 12-year-old than Ruby Frankie was with torturing her children. We'll leave it there.
So now you've you've convinced me. So we can all just forget everything I said at the beginning.
Listen, I beat you up here, and I didn't mean to. I like your what I call a 360 view. You know, you're able, I think, to look at the whole picture of a person more clearer and sharper than me. I am used to seeing people's happen. Crime committed, committed again, a million crimes committed, finally get caught, because for every time we catch somebody, we already know there's 100 more times that that crime was committed. Then when they see there's no way to get out of the crime, or the punishment, I should say, then they profusely apologize and make statements. And then if their sentence is reduced, the minute they get out, they do it again. So hopefully she'll never have any more children. I don't think she'll hopefully be biologically able to. Hopefully she won't adopt any children. Hopefully she won't be around anybody's children.
No more children ever.
And so she won't be in that situation. But anybody to me that's capable of doing that is also capable of harming and torturing and hurting others, because they don't.
Anyone other.
Yeah, anyone. You can do it to your own children. Really quick. Gosh, I'm going to digress.
No, wait, let me go back for one. I'm going to defend myself just for a moment, right? Because I did start out with this thing that I now don't agree with. That maybe, you know, her statement might have been, I don't know, you know, like maybe what I do think is we shouldn't be looking for criminal defendants to look like they have remorse, right? Everyone says it, right? Well, they didn't have any remorse at all, and we want them to show that they have remorse. No, we don't. We don't believe them. I think we should just stop looking at them for either an apology or remorse. We should just look at their actions. We should just look at the criminal actions, and we shouldn't be asking any more than that. Because this was the perfect example of someone who did a very careful person by person, I'm going to thank you, and I'm going to thank you, and I'm going to thank you. It doesn't really get any better than what she did in terms of, like, the act, what you called the act. And if that's not going to be convincing to us, we should just stop asking for it.
That whole thing made, I'm allergic to that point. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's a good point. Look, it is a good point, because what you're saying is really, it's disingenuous to ask somebody to come forward and apologize. And then when they apologize, say, well, you're lying. That's what your point is. And it is.
That's my point.
But I think my only counter to that, as I said before, if these people would just ever call themselves on the carpet, not just, I'm sorry, not just I did that, but the true, you know, I am sick human. I mean, it didn't come off that way. She came apologetic, and she came off, you know, anyway.
Thank you for saving my children, but not... Oh my God, did you see what I did to my children?
Yeah.
Did you see the scars on my children? Did you see the fact that I...
The real ownership. Like, in other words, I would have even appreciated her saying, I was capable of wrapping over and over and over again legs and then putting cayenne pepper on their wounds. I was capable of that, Judge. Think about that. I think all of us would have said... Wow, kind of like in Shawshank. Remember when Red, he goes in, I'm apologetic, you know, apologizes over and over, Morgan Freeman, in other words, his character was Red. And then at the end, he's authentic. He's like, listen, I've been in here forever. Whatever, I know what you're going to decide. And then they let him out. But I think it's the authenticity that whether you're an investigator or whether you're a judge or whether you're, you know, writing the probation or pre-sentence report, I should say, you're looking for just authenticity. And for me, I didn't think it was authentic.
There was nothing there. Right. There was nothing there. Yeah. So in a way we should, like, you know, Jodie Hildebrand was more honest, right? Like, she had really nothing to say, and maybe she's the more honest one in
maybe
all of
she
this.
Was more honest. Yeah. I did want to get your opinion on Mr. Frankie.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are calling for his arrest. They're calling for his indictment. What did he know? What do you think, Doc?
Well, I think what I would say about that is we need to go back and talk to the police officers who did the investigation, right? I mean, going back to law, you know, they did an investigation of him, and they're saying that they don't think he was guilty. They don't think they have enough to take him to trial. I don't know. I really don't know. I am suspicious of it. It seems a little bizarre that you wouldn't know anything at all about your children. It seems a little bizarre that you would be willing to completely walk away from six children, right? I mean, of course, these are the youngest. The other ones are adults or closer to adulthood. So first of all, that's a little sketchy, right? But the people who investigated him said, you know, we don't think we have enough to prosecute him. And I don't know what to say more than that, right? I think we have to go with what law enforcement says on this. They're not prosecuting him, and it's not like they didn't look at him. So.
Yeah. No, you say it very well. I will say, though, this, Dr. Upright, one thing that really bothered me regarding Mr. Frankie was, do you recall when the oldest daughter went and got all of the materials that were at the house, and she took them, not all of them, but, you know, books, papers, ledgers, different things like that, and she took them out of the house. And, of course, much of it belonged to Mr. Frankie. And he was incensed. And at one point, a law enforcement officer returns all of it to him. And he basically says, well, what are you going to do? I want her indicted. I want her to go to jail.
The daughter?
Yeah. This is what
I didn't know this, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Oh, the footage is just priceless to me because it gave me a window into him.
Interesting. I don't know this. I didn't know this. Yeah.
Still trying to punish. He wanted his daughter.
Yeah.
And remember, he had abandoned the house. He wasn't even there. I mean, were they his things? You know, yes, but his daughter took them out. Who would want, let me just ask this question, who would want, who loved their child to go to prison or jail? Who would want that? And here he's asking for it. He's pushing. Who do I talk to? Who do I need? And I think she gives him, well, you need to go down and try to make a charge or something like that. This is his mentality. Punish, punish, punish. That's all I needed to see to get into his head. And whether he knew or not is a big difference between whether law enforcement can prove it. A lot of times we think we know, but to get beyond that reasonable doubt threshold, which is what our prosecutors want.
So, yeah, it could be that we don't have enough evidence, but we do think he's sketchy. I mean, we think there's something wrong with him. I mean, he was part of all of this. He was part of this from the beginning. He allowed her to have control over the children, Rich. He allowed her to do these punishments. He allowed her to kick him out of the house, frankly. I mean, she really kind of took over, which is kind of weird if you think about the sort of religious background, the idea that she kind of took over, Yeah, it's a very interesting movement that he became the one that was subordinate. I'm not saying that men shouldn't be that and that women can't be powerful because, you know, you haven't met my husband. He's a great guy, but I'm definitely the articulate velociraptor as we talked about the last time I was with you. But it's not the script for their religious views by any stretch of the imagination that she would be the one that was dominant. But they really do come from a background that's punitive, right? They come from a background of Having all these children, and the children kind of, you know, the older children kind of become parentified, right? They become these parents for the other children, and then you have these sort of sharp disciplinarians at the top of it. We're the ones that drive the, you would always start out the eight passengers vlog with, hi, we're, you know, so-and-so, and we're the drivers of the eight passengers. And so it's a very hierarchical family structure. So, you know, my daughter betrayed me. Let's punish her.
We know their background is all Mormon. And as you said, in the Mormon faith, the men are completely in control. It's absolutely the hierarchy. There's no question. And so I would submit that he wanted to leave. That's just what I think. I would submit he left. I mean, especially after seeing that footage, and the only, you know, I haven't seen a lot of footage of him interacting with authority and law enforcement, but when I saw that, and it was a female officer that returned those things, he was so dominating and, you know, even toward her.
No, but I'm completely with you. I had not considered that. That makes a lot of sense to me, because it always seemed really strange that, you know, I'm the one that's subordinate. I'm going to leave, and maybe she'll let me back, right? What I'm just trying to do is I'm trying to get back in her good graces so that she'll let me back. So I'm going to stay away from the children. You might have explained it, because it's been puzzling to me, like, how did that happen, right? That's not really the sort of culture that they're from. It's not the culture that they promoted early on in the Eight Passengers vlog. I think you might be right. I don't know anything about his life otherwise. Did he have another partner when he left? You're right. How could it be in a hierarchical structure like this, which they both totally bought into? It wasn't like he was LDS and she wasn't. They both were. How could it be that he would have just so easily walked away and become subordinate and said, well, I'm just letting you, I just wanted to let me, you know, to come take me back. That's all I'm asking for. You're right. That is a kind of subordination that is pretty unlikely under those terms. I think we're going to
find another act for the cameras.
No, you're a genius. I mean, I think you've solved it, but now we need to know. I want to know. Let's investigate him.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much again. I mean, your time is so valuable. What you do as far as your teaching, your writing, you're just such a huge member in the community, in that community. And I just want to thank you for taking time out to talk again about these despicable people and for enlightening us, though, as to why maybe these despicable people do the things they do.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Till next time.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Break the Case. If you like what you saw, please go ahead and press the subscribe button and the like button. It doesn't cost a thing. And we love having you on our platform. Until the next time, may justice be served.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.